Hello, and welcome to the second installment of the History Twins podcast. I'm Tristan Kaplan.
And I'm Aiden Kaplan.
Today we are interviewing illustrious historian Matt Colt, Emeritus Professor of History at George Mason University. Matt specializes in Renaissance and Reformation era France, and his magnum opus is his France Wars for Religion, 1562 to 1629. He has also written The Duke of Anjou and the Politique During the Wars of Religion, and is the principal author of Renaissance and Reformation France. Now, Mac, your focus is clearly on the French Wars of Religion, so we'll dive right in. Many people think of the Wars of Religion as primarily a German affair during the 30 Years' War. Why is this wrong?
Well, people who think of the Wars of Religion as primarily German haven't studied European history very much in the 16th century. They never get past Luther. Luther was the first successful Protestant reformer. And there were peasant wars in Germany in the 1520s. There were wars between the Lutheran princes and the Emperor Charles V in the 1540s and 50s. But there was never a civil war in Germany like what broke out in France starting in 1562. So France was the only country in Western Europe where civilians murdered civilians, neighbors killed neighbors. Lots of countries suffered military violence during the Reformation, but France was the only one that had a civil war that lasted nearly 40 years.
How many casualties were there in this civil war?
Hard to say, because there were no such records kept. Some scholars have tried to take a look at burial records, but it's hard to, you can't tell from burial records who was killed as a result of the war and who just died naturally of old age. What we can say is that there are certain key moments, such as the St. Bartholomew's Massacre, where I think a fair estimation of casualties can be made. But overall, it's just impossible to say. But
best guess. Best guess.
I wouldn't even be able to guess. Certainly, there was nothing like the St. Bartholomew's Massacre, where maybe 2,000 people in Paris were killed in 48 hours, maybe another 4,000 in the provinces on top of that in the next month. But it's very, very difficult to say. You're not going to pin me down on that.
Well, you're a truth scholar, Mac. All right. So what focus of your research has been to place a certain emphasis on François, the Duke of Anjou? So who was this guy? Why was he important?
Interesting question. He was considered one of the most important European princes in his day.
I've never heard of him.
he was very well known to contemporaries because after his brother Henry III came to the throne in 1574, he proved unable to have a male heir. And his younger brother, François, Duke of Anjou, was the heir to the French throne. And by the early 1580s, everyone in France expected him to succeed his brother. He also had been engaged at one point to Queen Elizabeth of England. He could have become King Consort of England, and he was crowned the sovereign prince of the Low Countries in revolt against Spain. So his contemporaries saw him as someone who might one day wear three different crowns, a very important figure. Of course, he died of tuberculosis, predeceased his brother, never married Queen Elizabeth. He got run out of the Netherlands, and he never wore any of those crowns. So today, he is much more of a footnote in history, whereas in his own day, he was seen as very important.
And what was the significance of his death?
The significance of his death was that it made Henry of Navarre, the son of Jean d'Albret and Anthony, King of Navarre, the two Protestant leaders and leading noble family of the Huguenots in France, made him heir to the throne. He was the next closest male, legitimate male heir. There were no more Valois heirs. He was a member of the Bourbon family, and he would eventually become the first Bourbon king of France.
Excellent. That's Louis XIV's dynasty, right?
That's it. In the same dynasty as Louis XVI and Louis XVIII.
All right, so let's just zoom out a little here. Why did the French Wars of Religion start?
They started because the monarchy, beginning with Francis I in the early 16th century, continuing under Henry II in the 1540s, they were unable to eliminate Protestantism. They both attempted to suppress heresy, in their view. They wanted to keep Protestantism illegal. They didn't want any public Protestant services. They did their utmost to suppress it. But it had grown too quickly. Suppression simply proved unworkable. It didn't work. Protestants were converting largely because there were dozens and dozens of pastors trained in Geneva pouring into southern France, starting new Huguenot congregations. So they tried to suppress it. But France is a big place, much bigger than the tiny state of Saxony, where it, in other German states, where it's much easier to try to control religious uniformity.
Yeah, but as I was reading your book, I believe you said that only 10% of the population of France at most could have been Protestant. Is that correct?
That's correct. I don't know why you say at most 10%. France at the time was about 18 million people. So 1.8 million Protestants.
Yep.
You can defeat a Protestant army on the battlefield. What do you do with 1.8 million Protestants? You're going to arrest them all? You're going to torture them all? Uh-huh. You're going to force them to convert? It just proved impossible.
All right. So we tend to think of France as a very unified nation today, but it sounds like it may not have always been the case, especially here. We've got Protestants fighting Catholics. So could you just lay out a chessboard for us? What are the biggest Protestant areas of France, areas which maybe you don't share, like the French language, French culture, stuff like that? And are they big centers of dissent, as you might expect?
Well, France as we know it today, what the French call the hexagon, that's roughly the shape of France on a map, was a very recent construction. Much of France was not even part of France until after the 100 Years' War. That is, the duchies of Normandy, the duchy of Burgundy, Aquitaine, Brittany, they had all been controlled by independent princes until after the 100 Years' War. And when the French finally expelled the English in the middle of the 15th century, the kings of France in the second half of the 15th century started making deals to bring these other territories into France. Not all of them spoke the national French language. But in the 16th century, quite right, Protestantism initially took root in the south of France, in the regions of Languedoc and Provence. And if you take a map, it's almost like a crescent.
Yeah.
From the middle on the Atlantic side to the middle on the Switzerland side. And that's where probably about 75% of Protestants lived in France. But in most big cities, even in northern France, including the capital of Paris, there were always some Protestants there, and they were struggling to survive during the reigns of Francis I and Henry II, and even the short 18-month reign of Francis II. It was only once the wars of religion began that they began to win some very limited rights to exist in the various peace treaties ending each civil war.
Sure. So in the course of your history of the French Wars of Religion and biography of the Duke of Anjou, you frequently stress that all these kings and nobles are raising armies which they can't possibly maintain for very long, and they know this very well. Everyone else knows it too. So why do they keep doing this? Why do they keep raising armies that will just bankrupt them?
Because that is what nobles do. Nobles' job and their principal function in the feudal system of the medieval state where these things emerged was that nobles have certain privileges and rights. They don't have to pay taxes. They enjoy all kinds of other land and legal rights. But in return, they owe military service to the state. And they're trained. They male nobles, they spend their whole youth growing up training to be a soldier. That's what they do. They felt useless if they weren't fighting somewhere. And this proved to be a big problem because they could not only fight each other, they could also turn and fight the king, which occasionally happened during the Middle Ages.
Sir.
Yeah. So it gave them leverage. It made them feel powerful to have, say, 8,000-10,000 men, even if most of those men in 16th century were mercenaries, professional soldiers. They didn't get paid. They went home.
So I could understand why, especially some inexperienced young noblemen, like the Duke of Anjou, for instance, might continue dealing this. But wouldn't men like the Duke of Guise be a little more prudent about managing their funds? Like, why did he also do this sort of thing?
Well, the Duke of Guise did fight and bring his own military retainers to fight during the Wars of Religion against the Protestant armies, because he clearly believed and this was necessary to maintain and save a Catholic France. But he tended not to pick fights on the battlefield with other nobles. Guise was very good, and the Guise had lands all over France. They controlled territory not just in Lorraine, but also in Normandy, in Burgundy. They had clients everywhere, so they could call on a whole lot more people than most other French nobles. This made them a very powerful family in court.
Mm-hmm. All right, so Marxist historian Henry Heller, in a scathing critique to your putting history back into the religious war, says, "We are to follow Holt. It is not merely religion that ought not or cannot be related to secular causation, but likewise the wars of religion. Many other historians similarly critique you for not putting more weight on the class struggle theory of the Protestant Reformation and distinguishing between the two forces so much. So why are these class struggle-based historians wrong?"
Because there is almost no evidence to support that theory. I would not deny it all, and would certainly agree with Heller and other historians who would attack me on this, that there is very clearly class division, class tensions. When people went hungry after a harvest failure, you might find rioting. Those were garden variety class tensions that existed all the time. But to claim that the Reformation was founded on these class tensions, I just don't see much evidence to support that.
What about the other secular motivation of just nobles want more land, and it seems like exploiting the church is a good way of doing that? You can either break away from the church and thereby get church lands, or demand a better deal from the church, or you'll threaten them with going Protestant. So what do you think about that?
Nobles had always sought more land. That's very true. But that kind of, pardon my term, simplistic view, suggests that none of these nobles had, none of them had any sincere religious beliefs.
Maybe some of them did, but...
Maybe most of them did. And I think... another reason that I would give to sort of undermine that view is that the church proved, and maybe you would see this as supporting your view, I don't know, but the church provided a lucrative means of a career, and to suggest that because a bishop could become wealthy, he was a terrible bishop and didn't really have any religious sensibilities, was definitely true in some cases, but not true in others. And probably the best example, somebody who came along in the early 17th century, was Cardinal Richelieu. He made his career in the church long before he got involved in politics and was a very ardent Catholic.
So although you argue for religiously based interpretations of the French Wars of Religion, it seems to me like one of the characters who you place the most emphasis on, the Duke of Anjou, is in many ways one of the best counterexamples to this theory in terms of secular motivations, because he frequently sells out whatever, like his king, the brother, for the Protestants, and like switches back, like basically to gain whatever he can from it. You know, that's how he becomes the Duke of Anjou, is he fools his brother, he sides with the Protestants, and then... and to return for his service, the king once again gives him, the king gives him the Duchy of Anjou. So what do you think about that?
Well, clearly he was ambitious, opportunistic. He simply wanted respect that he felt was owed him. And of course, until he actually became a gang, no one really owed him anything. But to say he sided with the Protestants, some Protestant leaders sided with him because they saw him as a means of opposing the policies of his brother.
Yeah, well, sir, he could have gone against it, right?
He did.
Yeah, well, not the first time around.
Until
he would say that he stabbed him in the back at the Peace of Monsieur when he refused to demand even greater privileges for the Protestants.
Well, in 1576, in that peace treaty, the Protestants gained more than they had gained in any other peace treaty
until
that time.
Yeah, but as you point out, this seems to have all been fake demands, and almost like nobody really seemed to expect that he would follow up on them, the King of France. The King of France obviously doesn't follow up on any of them, and many Protestants seem very chagrined after they see that their biggest ally has deserted them.
Well, I would suggest you have a simplistic view of what any French king could do. Every peace treaty was a compromise. Neither side was happy at the end of each civil war. The Protestants gained a little limited legal recognition. There were certain places where they couldn't worship at all. There were certain rules they had to follow. Catholics were upset because Protestants were recognized under the law at all. They felt they shouldn't be recognized. Every peace treaty was signed with the hope that it would last. But Catholics, Catholic nobles, Catholic civilians were the ones who refused to accept each of these edicts of pacification. It wasn't that the king didn't follow up on it or should have followed up on it. When Catholic armies started attacking Protestants and the peace edict said, you're not allowed to arrest them unless they're breaking the law. Now, sometimes they did.
Yeah.
But it was just impossible to enforce these. Again, there were too many people on both sides who wanted complete victory, not the kind of compromise that each of these edicts was.
But it seems like what's really important for Protestant rights is when they have an area which is very solidly under their control, like La Rochelle. There, Protestants are worshiping freely and Catholics are getting persecuted. Whereas in areas where Catholics have dominance, then, again, it doesn't matter what the peace treaty says, the Catholics are in charge. So really, it seems like what the Protestants would like is for the Catholic rulers to get kicked out of a province and then for them to be made the rulers of the province and establish their own peace, and let probably keep the King of France out of it, except for him saying, good job, I give you this province now, go do what you want
to do. Oh, they would have loved that, but no French king was ever going to allow half of his state to simply be governed by other nobles.
Maybe not half, throw them a bone. Why can't you just say, like, Languedoc? That's already pretty Protestant. Go ahead, take Languedoc.
You're too ingrained in 21st century religious sensibilities, which they're private beliefs. They don't affect other people. The French crown did try to capture La Rochelle in 1573 after the St. Bartholomew's Massacre and failed.
Yeah.
They couldn't. They tried again and succeeded in the 1620s with the help of an English navy and by laying siege for 2 years, forcing them to surrender. Yeah. That's one city. There were over 40 cities fortified with walls, with Protestant troops. That's what the French crown could never defeat, even one by one, until the 17th century.
Yes, but they never admit that the Protestants have control, correct?
I think it depends on what you mean by
that. Yes, like in the peace treaty, they never say, we recognize that these areas are now under Protestant control.
Oh, no, they did.
They do that.
Yes.
And then, but they're still sending armies to attack.
Well, they're each of the peace treaties limits these cities.
Yeah.
And the Protestant, in a Protestant community, the Protestant army is also trying to take over more of these towns as well. Individual armies could defeat other armies on the battlefield. They couldn't enforce the terms of the peace treaty, not just the one they wanted to have, but the one they compromised. They couldn't even enforce that. You could argue, and some have, that Charles IX, Henry III were just not very strong kings. They couldn't command enough loyalty from the French people and the bulk of their nobility to prevent this from happening. But Charles V faced the same in Germany. He couldn't defeat the Lutheran princes. They ultimately both had to compromise and made the kind of settlement that you were talking about that France should have done. Yeah. Just let each region, each territory, let the local prince decide, and everybody lived happily ever after.
Yeah. But to the French king, this would have basically been permitting the Huguenot state within a state, which would have been this top priority to prevent.
And it would have gone against the oath he swore to God when he was crowned king of France to fight heresy.
So you think that was very important to him?
I think it was important, and the French people thought it was important. Certainly Catholics saw this as, the king of France selling out if he wasn't trying to do his utmost to eliminate Protestantism, and that's what the early kings tried to do. They just couldn't manage to do it.
So as I was reading your book on the French Wars of Religion, I noticed that the previous owner had crossed out a sentence which said there was no such thing as secular politics in the 16th century, your words, and instead written, wrong, just look at the Venetian Senate next to it. How would you go about convincing this person otherwise?
Well, whoever this reader was, I think he needs to pay a little closer attention to the Venetian Senate. They said Catholic Mass every time they met. To say that it was completely secular is just crazy. They were all Catholics. That there wasn't a Protestant Reformation there. But to say that religion and politics weren't combined, every ritual of the Senate in Venice was a religious ritual. The Senate led religious processions through the city on a regular basis. This reader needs to pay a little closer attention to the 16th century, where religion and politics couldn't be so easily separated.
All right. So, this is a very important question. What was the Estates General?
The Estates General in France rarely met until the 14th, 15th, 16th centuries, and then it seemed to meet quite a bit.
Yep.
And after 1614, it would meet again until 1789. A meeting of the three estates of the realm. The first estate was the clergy, the second estate was the nobility, the third estate represented all of the merchants, professional elites in the cities, the representatives of the towns. The third estate did not represent most of the population.
True, the peasants, of course.
The peasants, in the same way that the House of Commons in England only represented the gentry, the very wealthy landowners who weren't peers. It met in times of emergency. Only the king could convoke the three estates to meet together. And usually, up until the Wars of Religion, it was when the king needed money. If France was invaded, there were no standing armies until Louis XIV in the 17th century. So the king needed money. The three estates would come together. They, in theory, would assess and levy taxation and collect it, turn it over to the crown in times of emergency. They could also be called in times of fiscal crisis. If there were a series of poor harvests several years in a row, there was a food shortage, the Estates General might come together. But they were advisory. Yeah. They had no power to govern. They advised the crown. And because the Reformation couldn't be defeated in France, the Estates General was called in 1560, and again in 1561, 1576, 1588, 1593. They could never solve the long-term structural problems that French kings convoked them to address.
So why did Henry III think that the Estates General at Blois, I'm probably mispronouncing it, sorry, would aid him financially?
It was a last resort. He had convoked the estates in 1576, which also met at Blois, and they didn't give him exactly what he wanted. In fact, many of the deputies there were saying, we want to spend less on war. We want peace. And it was a last desperate attempt to try to win support. Henry was already losing a propaganda battle with the Guise family. He was not very popular. He had done numerous things to try to win over the popularity even of Paris. He went barefoot in religious processions along with various monastic orders, but nothing seemed to work. And he was simply powerless to find some kind of policy that he could get the royal council and his nobility to enforce. So it was a desperate gamble. And, of course, the most desperate gamble of all was his decision to assassinate Guise and Guise's brother, which backfired on him completely.
Yeah. All right, so why did the Huguenot elite want to con the States General so badly then? So it kind of sounds to me like it's distracting Henry III, but it's also giving him an opportunity to raise funds, is it not?
Yeah, well, the Huguenots were not represented in the estates, so they...
But they thought they would be, right?
Yes, well,
why did they think they would be?
Well, because they did have some spokesman who sympathized with them in 1576. They thought that might be true again. But the only estates the Huguenots controlled were the provincial estates in Languedoc, in Provence, because these provinces maintained their own estates that raised taxation in those areas. But the National Estates General, all of the outspoken voices were Catholics. Now, they were divided between militant Catholics that supported all-out war and the Guises, and more moderate Catholics who wanted a ceasefire, who didn't want to give 100% religious toleration to the Huguenots, but wanted to stop the fighting. Because they realized this was just destroying France as a nation.
Sir. All right, so let's just, we've touched on this a little, but why don't you just give us a quick summary of who Henry IV was?
Henry of Navarre, born in Pau in southwestern France in the independent kingdom of Navarre, which straddles the Pyrenees on the French side and the Spanish side. And his father was King of Navarre. He inherited that title. His mother converted to Protestantism, Jean d'Albret, when back before he was even born. So he was brought up a Protestant. But because his father, Anthony of Bourbon, was still a member of the royal family, distantly related, a cousin to the Valois, going back through the younger brother of King Louis IX, the Bourbon line descended. So they commanded some respect. But Jean d'Albret had organized and led a Protestant political movement in the Southwest, and her son was reared to support that movement, which he did. His cousins, the Condés, the Prince Condé, also members of the Bourbon family, became initially the leading Huguenot nobles. Navarre would take over that role after Admiral Coligny was assassinated in the St. Bartholomew's massacres in 1572. So, and in 1584, he became next in line to the throne of France, as we've already said.
But he was still a Protestant then?
He was still a Protestant. He had been forced
to convert
convert to Catholicism in 1572, because he was imprisoned at court along with the Duke of Anjou. They both managed to escape a few years later, and when he escaped, he renounced his conversion as being forced on him. It was not genuine. He went back to openly practicing Protestantism.
So in your book, The French Wars of Religion, you write, what might have happened had Henry IV not been struck down by an assassin in May 1610 is one of the most intriguing counterfactual questions of French history. So what would have happened?
Well, historians aren't very good at predicting the future. We try to predict the past. So we can't say for sure what would have happened. We can present maybe several scenarios of what could have happened, what might have happened. The one thing he managed to do that previous kings had not was end the fighting of the civil wars. He managed with the peace edict of Nantes in 1598, which was based primarily on the Peace of Monsieur in 1576. It extended a few more rights, but ultimately it guaranteed Protestants the right to exist in France, gave them freedom of conscience, but not freedom of worship. They couldn't worship anywhere in public like Catholics could. It made them second-class citizens. They were given some legal rights. That is, all of the parliament was supposed to have a split chamber of half Protestants, half Catholics. Never happened anywhere. In some provinces, they put one Protestant judge in the parliament, but many of the provinces, they just never created these bipartisan chambers. But for Catholics, it cemented that public life in France was going to remain Catholic. And Catholicism was the only religion that was going to be the public religion of and the face of the state and the court. And what benefited Catholics was that in those parts of southern France where Catholic Mass had not been said in 40 years, the Mass was reintroduced. Uh-huh. And Catholics were now given back their rights to practice their religion, which they had been denied. But again, neither side was completely happy. For Protestant civilians, not soldiers, not nobles, they saw this maybe as the best trade they could get. Because Henry IV promised the Huguenots, his former co-religionaires, he would stop the persecution. He would never persecute them again if they obeyed the law and recognized him as king. And nearly all civilian Protestants did. A few nobles didn't. And they decided to go to war against the king in the 1620s. Henry IV managed to bring about an end to the violence. And it wouldn't be permanent because violence would break out in cities and towns where Protestants and Catholics lived together, particularly in the south of France, where Catholicism was restored for the first time since the beginning of the Wars of Religion. So there might have been a more stable peace between Protestants and Catholics. France might have achieved, and I say might, something much closer to a modern form of religious toleration sooner, although I'm pretty skeptical and cynical, because the first time French Huguenots were given the right to worship and practice anywhere in France wasn't until just before the French Revolution.
Really?
At the same time in England, the Toleration Acts, and we praise John Locke, wrote the treatises of government, our democracy and representative system is based on. He wrote a treatise on religious toleration.
Saying that we, the Catholics, of course, those guys. Yeah.
Every Protestant denomination was tolerated, but not Catholics.
Not Catholics, of course not.
And that's, you know, this is much closer, this is 100 years later.
Yeah.
So, and when religious toleration, the separation of church and state in this country, at the time of the American Revolution, it was controversial. Many Americans disagreed with it.
Yeah.
As you know, some still do.
Yes, of course.
So this is a religious pluralism, which is what we're talking about, allowing multiple religions to exist peacefully. This is a really modern thing. And we're a long way from that in the French Wars of Religion.
So the quote perhaps most commonly attributed to Henry IV is, "Paris is worth a mass." However, as you point out, he never actually said this, correct?
Correct.
All right. So to what extent does this discredit the standard depiction of Henry IV as an insincere convert to Catholicism?
You still find that quotation in high school, even college, university textbooks.
Yep.
You find it in Wikipedia.
Yeah, it shocked me when I read this. Yeah.
And it was the product of League propaganda, militant Catholic who were opposed his becoming king. I mean, he had technically been king since August 1589, when Henry III was assassinated, but he wasn't crowned in Chartres Cathedral and anointed with the holy oil and all of the religious rituals until after he abjured Protestantism and converted to Catholicism. Certainly, the traditional view of Henry IV is just a religious opportunist.
Yeah.
And it, not only because of his conversion, but going back to his early career, you know.
How many times does he convert?
He converts genuinely only once.
Yes, but how many times does he say he converts to Catholicism and then switches back, or Protestantism and then switches back?
He was forced to convert at sword point in 1572. As soon as he left court, he renounced that. He never renounced it again until 1593.
Yep.
And it's created an image of him as being just a religious opportunist, not a serious Protestant, not a serious Catholic. And the most recent research of the last 20 years has undermined that. He was a sincere Protestant. He hated renouncing his religion because he felt it could jeopardize his salvation. This is not something that 21st century politicians tend to worry about with their religious views about whether they're going to heaven or not. But he did everything he could to prove to his Catholic subjects that his conversion, his abjuration of Protestantism, and his taking instruction and converting to Catholicism was real. And for the rest of his life, he went out of his way. When he first entered the city of Paris in 1594, it happened to be during Easter week. And he, you know, the Spanish troops had fled. The city opened its doors to him. He was now a Catholic king. They declared their loyalty to him. And because it was Easter week, he did what previous French kings had done. He washed the feet of the poor on Maundy Thursday, went to Mass on Good Friday, and he did all the things that Catholic kings had done. And sure, he was trying to win over the loyalty of the French people who had been opposed to him, and violently opposed to him up until his conversion.
Yeah.
I suppose the more nuanced view of Henry now is he sacrificed his own personal religion for the sake of the French state. He knew he was never going to be able to challenge the coronation oath. He was never going to be accepted by the majority of the French population without converting.
Yeah.
And if he decided, okay, I'll just abdicate my duty as king, then what would have happened? Even worse and much more continued civil war.
Yes. most likely, yes.
Because then there would have been a more serious problem, as there would have been no legitimate heir for any side to rally around with any kind of justification.
All right. So I suppose we've already gone over this a little, but what exactly was Guise? We say Henry, Duke of Guise, but what is Guise? What's he the Duke of?
Well, Guise is a family name. He was Duke of Lorraine.
Yeah.
And his family was originally from Lorraine, that territory south of Alsace on the French-German border. But the Guise family was very wealthy. Francis, Duke of Guise, Henry's father, and Charles, Cardinal of Bourbon, Henry's uncle, Francis's brother, were two of the wealthiest men in France at the beginning of the Wars of Religion. And the Guise family owned land, not just in Lorraine. They had huge sections of land in Normandy. They were also governors of Burgundy. They had clients scattered throughout most of northern and central France. So the Guise family was powerful because of their wealth, and they would have been formidable under any kind of political scenario. But given the weakness of Charles IX and Henry III as kings, the Guises stepped forward to try to fill that void. And they wanted to preserve Catholicism. They saw the growth of Protestantism, 1.8 million people. They saw this as a threat to every Catholic salvation in France.
They say the Guise family was from Lorraine. Wouldn't that have made them foreigners in the eyes of many at the French court?
No, because the distinction between native and foreigner that we have today was a little different then. The word foreigner existed.
But certainly used against the Italians and such.
In Paris, a foreigner was somebody from Normandy. A foreigner was somebody from Languedoc. A foreigner was somebody from a different region. And when, you know, they spoke a different language in Brittany and a different language in Provence, and foreigner was something else. The Guise spoke French. Their court in Nancy was culturally French. It was a French-speaking, they were a French-speaking family. And their ancestors had been members of the royal council at the French court, just like they were. So they owned land. They technically, the family originated in territory that wasn't part of the French state. But as I'm sure you know, under Louis XIV, that would change.
Yep.
Decided to annex Alsace and Lorraine.
Yep. So why was Henry Duke of Guise so trusting of Henry III?
Yes, and you've already begun to dispute this, but let's just get your response.
Well, I think the question is too general. At certain points in time, I think maybe Henry Duke of Guise, I don't know whether trust is the right word, certainly showed respect to Henry III as King of France.
Right. And he was a stalwart Catholic, of course. Yeah. So, yeah.
But as a stalwart Catholic, having attempted to do what his father had done to suppress Protestantism and failed, he saw very little way out other than some kind of religious coexistence. And that's what the Guise family absolutely hated. They didn't want Protestants to have any legal rights in France at all. And when Henry reluctantly recognized, this is after the death of his brother, Anjou, in 1584, Henry III recognized Henry of Navarre as his legitimate heir. And this just sent a number of Catholics, including the Guise family, through the roof, because that threatened the whole French state, in their view. We couldn't have a heretic as king. The French constitution, like all constitutions of states in this period, was unwritten. But the French constitution required the king to be Catholic and required the king to fight against heresy and protect the kingdom from heresy. And to have a heretic as heir to the throne, this was unheard of. And the question was, he was legitimate by blood, but illegitimate by religion. And of course, most French Protestants, all French Protestants, and even some Catholics, thought being legitimate by blood ought to take precedence.
So the day before Henry III, Henry III ordered Henry Duke of Guise to be killed, like, why did Henry, Duke of Guise, think that, like, there wouldn't be some plot against his life? Why did he think that he would be perfectly secure just going to Blois, as the king instructed? And
I think, well, no one can get inside of his head, but I think he was so confident, having won over the people of Paris, which caused Henry III to flee in the Day of the Barricades just a few months earlier. He felt, you know, he was in charge. Everybody respected him. I think, you know, he simply didn't think Henry III would do something so stupid as to try to assassinate him. And maybe he saw how stupid this was much more clearly, obviously, than Henry III did. This clearly was not a plan shared with the royal council, and it was definitely not shared with his mother, Catherine de Medici, who was horrified because she knew exactly what this meant. Religious violence is going to just break out all over again. And the sort of last civil war, the war of the so-called War of the Three Henrys.
But one Henry down, right?
Well, one down. but it was going to be more violent and bloodier than the previous wars. And it proved to be.
Yeah. And to tie this in with my previous question, would it be fair to say that Guise was a little more cocky, overconfident than he was actually trusting of Henry III?
I would be willing to agree with that, yes.
Okay, so not so much trusting as, you know, perhaps disbelieving as well.
Yeah,
he just couldn't imagine that the King of France would order him killed.
Too shrewd.
Yes. Too shrewd to realize how other people might not be as shrewd. All right. So what should Henry III have done when he came back from Poland in 1574 following the death of his brother, Charles IX?
Oh, yeah. Well, why was he in Poland, first of all?
Why don't we start with that? What was he doing in Poland?
Well, Poland's monarchy became vacant. Like certain titles in Western Europe, it was an elective position.
Mm-hmm.
And the Polish nobles chose Henry of Valois. At the time, he held the title Duke of Anjou.
Yeah.
As the new king. Now, they didn't just decide, oh, who's the best person we could find in all of Europe? Oh, it's Henry. No, it didn't work like that. In fact, there was a lot of pressure and propaganda to get him chosen.
Right, but also money, right?
So he was in Poland because he was elected king. Now, he obviously didn't speak a word of Polish, mm-hmm. and he was hardly there at all before his brother Charles IX died in May 1574, and he began making his way back to France. Now, you ask, what should he have done? Well, there's no clear-cut program that would have turned him into a successful king, maybe, but clearly what people expected him to do is what he had done before he left France to go to Poland. He had been a successful military leader on the battlefield against Protestant armies. He had won two major battles against them in 1569, 1570. He had proven himself to be a heroic, courageous figure on the battlefield. When he got back to France,
that sort of changed.
He never got on a horse again. He became almost a Jekyll and Hyde figure. He wanted to be known as the king of the intellectuals. He wanted to be known as king of the religious orders. He wanted to have his own private group of favorites in court, many of whom were nasty pieces of work and not well liked. He did just the opposite. Had he remained the person they expected him to be, things might have turned out differently. Did he have the intellectual ability and the temperament of character to become as powerful a figure and as popular a figure as Henry IV later would? That's probably doubtful.
All right. So what was the Duke of Guise's plan exactly? So taking over Paris, but like the king was still obviously in conflict with him. So did he hope to resolve his differences with the king first and then go after the Protestants, or perhaps root out the evil within Catholicism first and then go after the Protestants? Or what did sources say?
Duke of Guise never wrote down a plan. I mean, sure, if you want to know his plan, you go ask him. Clearly, he wanted to defeat the Protestants.
Yep.
He wanted to overturn all of the peace edicts that guaranteed them legal rights to exist, even in the cities they currently held in the South with garrison Protestant troops there. He wanted that situation to end. How do you do that? You would have needed a standing army of, oh, I don't know, 500,000 men.
Wow.
And unlimited money to keep them in the field for several years to lay siege to each one of these cities. It was impossible. What sort of reasonable plan might he have had? Certainly he wanted the king, Henry, to turn his attention back to defeating Protestants in southern France and lead an army down there. Henry was completely unwilling to do this. But in the face of that, what was his plan in 1588 at the States General? I mean, the day before he was killed, what was he planning? What was he hoping to do? He was hoping to win over support amongst all the Catholic nobility to combine into one large army, hopefully led by the king, but it seemed pretty clear at this point that wasn't going to happen, to defeat the Protestants in southern France. Realistically, was that possible? Probably not. But again, he was very confident of his abilities.
Overconfidence once again. All right. So why don't we just change things up a little? So you're also an expert on Burgundian history, are you not? And I feel like we should get a view of what's going on in Burgundy during the French Wars of Religion.
Well, what happened in Burgundy is an interesting case study of the entire religious wars, because there was an emerging Protestant movement there in the 1550s. In the capital city of Burgundy, Dijon, there was probably 500 to 600 Protestants in a city of maybe 12,000. Not 10%, but still a significant number of people. But that Protestant movement never grew. In fact, it contracted pretty quickly because of pressure from the local church and state in Burgundy. That is, Burgundy remained a stronghold of Catholicism. And those French Protestants in Burgundy began converting to Catholicism through force. That is, they were arrested and their property confiscated. They weren't allowed to keep their property unless they converted to Catholicism. This conversion process started slowly at the time of the St. Bartholomew's Massacre in Paris. It speeded up very quickly. And all the Protestants in the city of Dijon were rounded up and put in prison and were told, we expect you to convert to Catholicism if you want to keep your property and your household and your goods. And there was a large mass conversion. So Burgundy remained a bastion of Catholicism. And during this whole period, the Guise family were the royal governors of the province of Burgundy. And they controlled the munitions and all the fortified towns. That is, there was if you've been to Williamsburg, the powder magazine where powder is stored. Well, every city that had a wall around it had one of these. And the royal governor was the only one to control that, not the mayor of the city, not the local elites, the royal governor. So Burgundy remained very strongly Catholic. And another reason for that was that the church had invested heavily in the wine industry in Burgundy going back into the Middle Ages.
Sure.
So the largest single cohort of people in the Dijon's 12,000 population, over 2,000 of them worked in the wine industry. I mean, grape pickers, yeah. Wine harvesters. And they remained tied to the Catholic Church. And they were... They led all the demonstrations against Protestant worship services. Burgundy just remained a strong Catholic territory. And during the time of the League, the Burgundy was loyal to the Duke of Mayenne, who was the brother of Henry, Duke of Guise, and was sort of the leader of the League after Guise's assassination in 1588.
So it sounds like Burgundy is unusual in how stalwart Catholic it is out of all of the provinces of France. Would you say that's correct?
Well, there were other Protestant provinces like that.
Yeah.
I would say Brittany was very similar up in the extreme north of France.
Of course, Brittany would barely be part of France at the time, right?
Well, it was legally, it had been brought into France at the very end of the 15th century.
Yep.
They had their own parliament, they had their own estates, but they were part of the French crown. So legally, the Duke of Brittany was a vassal of the King of France in the same way that the Duke of Burgundy, although there was no Duke of Burgundy during the Wars of Religion.
Yep.
But for Parisians, I mean, these were all foreign countries. But France, we need to think of in the 16th century, not as real estate with frontiers and borders that are very hard and defined. Think of France not as real estate. Think of it as a group of people. Those people who declared their sovereign to be the King of France. That was France. France was wherever they were.
But wouldn't most peasants have had no idea who the King of France was?
Some peasants wouldn't know. Maybe a lot of peasants wouldn't know. But a lot would, because...
Wouldn't they have identified more with their church and, town than their city or, even, the king, or, the king himself? Wouldn't have been
they,
way
they
out there?
They would. They would. But they all had to pay taxes. If they used any currency at all, it would have the portrait of the king. That is, lots of rural communities were probably cut off from what was going on. And their only knowledge or interaction with politics was if the wars intervened on their own lives. But there were large parts of France where what you describe was true, but these are the extreme rural parts, the growing parts, the cities, the suburbs, the towns. Everybody knew who the king was there. But there were still pockets as late as the second half of the 19th century where people didn't know who the King of France was.
Well, probably in the second half of the 19th century, they might not have even had a king.
Well, they wouldn't have known who the president of France. They wouldn't know anything about the French government. That is, they were so remote. And, I mean, there's a famous book by one of the Levy brothers, I can't remember whether it's Carlo or Primo Levy, describing anthropologists going up into the mountains in central Italy. And they reached a certain point where no one had heard of Christianity beyond that. And his book was titled Christ Stopped at Eboli. That was the village, the last village where they knew what Christianity was. I mean, rural areas were remote. I mean, there just wasn't the connection, even in the 20th, never mind what there is today with technology and social media. So the premise of your question is absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. So, Nick, now that you're retired, are you planning on writing any more books?
The answer is yes. I just had a book published last week.
I saw that.
on Burgundy during the Wars of Religion.
Right.
And I'm currently working on a book on French translations of the Bible in the 16th century. I'm less interested in the actual translations than in how people read them. One of the cliches of the Reformation is the Catholic Church kept the Bible in Latin, forbade anyone to read it in anything but Latin, which doesn't happen to be true.
Yeah.
But when it did become widely available in the vernacular languages, French in France, and the first complete French translation was published in 1530, and dozens of them appeared thereafter. I'm examining surviving copies to look for underlining, marginalia, any kind of reaction to the text by a reader. And it's problematic because I have to decide, is this 16th century handwriting? In most cases, I don't know who made these marks. In some cases, the owner wrote their name, and I can see the same handwriting later in the Bible. But a number of Bibles were passed down from one generation to the next, and you can see on the inside fly leaves, they write down the names of their children, godparents, baptisms. So they're owned by more than one generation of owners. But I'm putting together a database, trying to collate. And I've looked at about 500 copies so far. And there are nearly 3,000. I'm not going to try to do them all because it's taken me 5 years to do these. But yes, I will be writing a book on this, on what people got out of their Bible reading, which parts they were most interested in, least interested in. And I've already published an article on this, but it will become a book soon, I hope. Well, within the next 2-3 years.
So you're certainly not the kind of history professor who retires and then stops doing history.
No. The only reason I'm retiring is so I can do more of that.
All right.
And not have to go to committee meetings and grade papers.
All right. Well, keep up the good work. Yeah, that sounds great. All right. So thanks to our watchers, and thanks again to you, Professor Holt, for being here today. If you enjoyed this installment of the History Twins podcast, there will be another next month, which will also be available on iTunes and SoundCloud. Until next time, I'm Aiden Kaplan.
And I'm Tristan Kaplan.
And together we are the History Twins.